All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? How's everybody holding up? How are you doing? How's that thing you went to see? What's going on with that thing on your hand? I'm sorry that you lost your job. How you doing with all the insanity weather-wise? How you doing with the snow, the floods, the fires? How are you doing with all the insanity that's going on culturally, politically? What's happening? Are you holding it together? Are you eating correctly? Try to, stay engaged in a way where you can manage it. Try and be realistic and adapt and figure out how to move forward, because as old Hunter said, in a generation of swine, the one-eyed pig is king. And that's diplomatic in terms of, where we're at now. But old Hunter knew what he was talking about. Going to go back and read some of those books. So, I don't know, man. Today, I'm here, and I'm aware, and I'm trying to figure out a way through day to day, figure out how I can help, what I can do, who needs help, how can I help them, that kind of stuff. Being charitable, being decent, being respectful, having tolerance, having empathy. Stay on top of it, will you? Stay on top of it. Today, actually, I get to have a real conversation about real global things with Mo Ammer. He's a comic with two stand-up specials on Netflix. He was a cast member on the series Rami. He's got his own series on Netflix called Mo, which is now in its second season. And it's terrific. I welcome and I completely consume and learn from television series created by artists who are of a certain background that is not necessarily contextualized culturally. Good examples are Sterling Harjo, and Rami Youssef. Like, these are things the world of the reservation, I knew nothing about. I just didn't, and maybe that's on me. And Rami's experience as an Arab Muslim here in the States was unique to me in terms of what that community was like, the struggles within the community, his struggles with Islam, all that stuff, in terms of how these communities live in this country. And with Mo's series, he's a Palestinian-American and comedian, and his family is Palestinian, and what they've lived with and been through and what they hold on to historically, traditionally, and familially in terms of being in this country was an eye-opening, mind-blowing experience. And we were able to really kind of have a discussion about that, about his life, about Palestine, about American Palestinians, and, I as a Jew and Mo as a Palestinian. But the bottom line is, and oddly the most important thing about the conversation, is that we're both comedians. And we both love comedy and have a personal history with comedy and some heroes in common. But we are able to talk about the other stuff. Look, I talk about things. I talk about my fears. I talk about the politics of this country. Look, I knew and know what's going on in Gaza is awful, and I've stated that, but I do get a little preoccupied with what's in my own backyard in terms of the ongoing shift from democracy into some sort of competitive authoritarianism, which is a documented term that you should probably look up. There's been some articles about it. It's sort of what Hungary is and what Hungary became through that autocrat, Viktor Orban, who is a big hero to some of the right-wing pseudo-intellectuals in terms of the shameless shift that they support away from liberal democracy in this country. And as it's starting to unfold, we're going to start hearing questions we haven't heard in a long time, if ever. Oh, so what, you got polio? Damn, dude. Damn. Well, Tesla has an iron lung available. It's pretty, it's kind of weird looking, but it's bulletproof. So that's good. And wait a couple of years. So how was Paris? I haven't been there since it's been part of Russia. Yeah, these are All possible questions. Have you gone to Canada lately? Yeah, they won't let Americans in. I guess rightfully so. Yeah, it's all going to get more and more exciting. But the bottom line is, for me, it's understanding, you know, what is happening to the best of my ability with real facts and adjusting to that. And then hopefully, as we move into this, figure out how we can resist in a way that's not just personal or self-centered or self-righteous in terms of the small things you can do in your life to push back, because I don't know how much that really affects anything. I got a friend of mine who's, boycotting Amazon. All right, well, good luck with that. Good luck with it. Boycotting Whole Foods. Good luck with it. I don't know if that's going to make a big difference, but if it makes you feel better, I guess that's not nothing, but it actually, it might be nothing. Look, I'm in Asheville, North Carolina at the Orange Peel this Thursday, February 20th. Nashville, Tennessee at the James K. Polk Theater this Friday, February 21st. Louisville, Kentucky at the Baumhart Theater Saturday, February 22nd. And Lexington, Kentucky at the Lexington Opera House on Sunday, February 23rd. Back at Largo here in Los Angeles on Tuesday, February 25th. In March, I'll be in Oklahoma City at the Tower Theater on Thursday, March 6th. Dallas at the Majestic Theater, Friday, March 7th. Houston at the White Oak Music Hall, Saturday, March 8th. And San Antonio at the Empire Theater on Sunday, March 9th, before I head to South by Southwest that week. Then I'm coming to South Carolina, Illinois, Michigan, Toronto, Vermont, New Hampshire, New York City. Then at the end there for my special taping, go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my dates and links to tickets. All right. I'll tell you, it's funny talking to Mo Ammer. I kind of knew him, but I didn't really know him. And he's a Texas guy. So we were able to sort of get into that history of Texas comedy. You know, I was sort of involved in some ways with the legacy of that through Kennison, and I'm back into the original Houston Outlaws. But Ammer's been doing it a while, and he's been doing it since he was a kid, so it's kind of wild to share these American comedy histories about places you came up in, if they have a comedic personality or profile or backstory. So that was good. It's all very weird. Entertainment, business, right now. I watched that SNL 50, and it's just, I don't know, man. That was quite a room full of people there. That was quite an audience outside of the people that have been on the show. Man, that just must have been a battle of the publicists to get people into those seats, the ones who wanted them. And yeah, I looked at that. I looked at show business. I looked at all of them in one room. And fucking Keith Richards was there, which always makes me happy when he's sitting anywhere, to be honest with you. But there were a lot of people in there, and I'm looking at him. I'm like, oh my God, is that the face of the resistance? We've got to broaden that thing. We got to get the people out there. People are getting out there, which is encouraging. But also, people are getting so old. It's difficult. I don't know that I'm comfortable with old, and I'm getting old myself. It was quite stunning that Garrett Morris got out there and sat in a chair, and he almost looked like a character Garrett Morris was playing. He was playing an old Garrett Morris. And that conversation I had with him was kind of amazing. But I do like seeing everybody in the room and having a good time, and some of the stuff was funny. But Jesus Christ, I mean, come on. Eddie Murphy doing Tracy Morgan outside of Sandler Song was really probably the high point of that thing. It's kind of incredible when you see, anytime you see Eddie Murphy choosing to turn on the juice, you know, to be funny Eddie Murphy is always a treat. So look, Mo Ammer is here. We get into it. But more than anything else, it's two comedians talking. One, a Palestinian-American, and one, a Jew. It's just people. We're just humans. And this is me talking to Mo Ammer.
It's
So I didn't realize you still live out there in Texas. In Houston.
Yeah. No, I'm in Houston. I never wanted to leave.
There's like that one place, like when I go to Houston, I always like Houston, you know, more than the other places.
It's my favorite.
Much fucking great art around.
Yeah.
And then there's like this Indian place I eat at some mall.
You're talking about, in the mall?
Well, it's not.
In strip mall?
No.
You're talking about Aga's?
No, it's in like.
Himalayas.
It's in a fancy kind of shopping area. They do kind of a hip Indian thing.
Nice.
Oh, man.
Listen, man, in Houston, it's all about Aga's.
Aga's. Yeah. That's the Indian?
It's Pakistani, but same shit. But
yeah.
It's like the greatest South Asian food you've ever had. These guys have like 13,000 Google reviews, and it's 4.8 stars.
Oh, yeah. It's right there. Aga's.
Yeah.
What the fuck am I thinking of? Like, because
Aga's is like insanely delicious.
Now that I'm like vegan, I'm always.
You love it.
Though, Pondicherry. That's what I'm thinking.
Pondicherry. Yeah, I know. Pondicherry.
That's all right.
Yeah, my wife
right?
loves Pondicherry.
No, yeah, it's good.
Yeah. It's all vegetarian, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so. But it's good. It's a little hip. It's not like traditional.
It's good. No. There's also like a Hindu temple like up north.
That's the thing about Houston. It's so fucking huge, and there's so many different kinds of people. Yeah. It's crazy.
It is. It's like the most diverse city in America.
That's what I was just going to say. Like, I used to live in Queens, in Astoria, and I thought, that's pretty diverse, but there's not as many people.
No, nowhere near as many people, but also, like, I think that once you think of Texas, you imagine the South, the deep South. That's what you imagine.
But Houston's.
You know, it's the most diverse city in America.
It's crazy.
According to Forbes magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was pitching my show, I was like, yo, this is kind of insane that no one's ever filmed a series in Houston.
Yeah, because of the diversity.
It's diversity, but also like the export of music that's come out of Houston.
Yeah.
From the hip hop scene. I mean, my God, Beyonce. And everything in between, from Bun B to the hip hop scene itself.
Yeah.
Slim Thug, Paul Wall, all these guys. I mean, Lizzo's from there, Travis Scott.
The
top grossing artists in the world right now. Like,
it's all Houston.
Yeah, but nobody like.
Well, really, there was also
50 Cent just moved there, but he's not from there. But he's kind of like
50 Cent moved there.
Yeah, he just moved to Houston.
And back in the day, the comedy outlaws, Hicks, Kennison.
Yeah, of course.
Who was it? Freddie Asparagus, Friedman, a couple other guys.
Ron Chalk.
Ron
is one of my all-time favorites.
I interviewed him years ago, and then he died. Ron was kind of fun.
I actually they asked me to put together a camera crew to film his like last appearance
Before he died?
No, before he died.
Get the fuck out of here.
It was at the Comedy Showcase in Houston. I really get emotional thinking about it because, to me, he's one of the greatest storytellers I've ever seen in my whole life.
Yeah,
it's
great. Yeah, he was great.
And so that footage has like never been released. I don't know what happened to it.
Really? You don't know what happened to it?
No, it's not mine.
Oh.
I just helped direct it and put it together.
Being up in Canada with him, he'd always be stocking up on those Tylenols with codeines. He'd get like a year's supply.
Those Tylenol 3s? Yeah. My back.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You don't even need to complain in Canada.
They're right there on the shelf. There. Well, that's nice.
So I can't remember. When did we meet? I remember having some moment where we were on the show, same show together, and I didn't even know you, and I just looked at you, and I'm like, fuck, do I got to follow that guy?
No.
I don't know what he's going to do.
I don't even remember, honestly.
I don't know what he's going to do, but it's going to be big.
Yeah. It just kind of like everything you kind of mashed into, like, you know, you see comedians in all these different settings. It's hard to remember exactly where you.
Well, I think it was at. I think it might have been
we hung out
at the store.
Yeah, it was definitely at the store, too.
At the comedy store is when I saw you first. Yeah. But, like, I didn't know your shit that much. And then I watched both seasons of the show.
Yeah.
And
you saw the second season?
I did.
You sent it to you? Oh, amazing.
Yeah, it's great. The whole thing's great.
Thank you.
And, you know, and I love it because, like, you know, there's so much I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, even I had the same experience watching Rami's show, and I'm like, I didn't know about this. These Muslim guys are just living here, you know? They got whole communities and lives.
I just know halal guys.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
Easy on the hot sauce.
But I just don't know, and I think it's a unique thing that the way of life and the community is represented. You know, I felt that way when I watched Reservation Dogs.
Yeah.
I'm like, how the fuck, you know, we have this sense of, you know, what natives or Arabs are like, but you don't, you know, you can't frame them in just the sort of ordinary context unless you know them.
No, absolutely.
Because we don't travel, and there's not a lot of crossover.
No, there isn't. And it's not like there's been a great depiction in film and television at all.
Yeah, of course not.
If any, you know what I mean? It's always been like Jafar, you know, like it's like some guy on a carpet flying around, which is very entertaining, honestly.
Yeah, it
like,
is. And those carpets fly, don't they?
They do. I mean, if you pray enough, if you really pray enough, you could teleport to another dimension.
I will tell you, after watching the last special and both seasons of the show, you know, my appreciation for hummus and olive oil has taken, it's a new depth. I have new depth. Well, you know, I always liked it, but like, you know, it's so omnipresent in both the special and the shows. I'm like, holy fuck, I've really got to consider this in a real way now.
Yes, please do. Please do, because it's wildly irritating when people don't. Like, you just walk into a fucking restaurant, and they're like, here's your hummus. I'm like, it's grainy. Yeah. It's, like, in a sauce side, and it's, like, carrots and fucking, what is this? What is this?
Yeah, like, well, I understand the purest approach to it, because when I was in Astoria, you go up to the Egyptian place, and they give you hummus, and you're like, I can't, no matter what kind of food processor I have, I can't get it to this texture. There's like no way I can get it this smooth, and then like, I get obsessed with it. And even watching your show, I'm like, what is the special grinder that's going to get it this smooth?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's really, I even have problems
with the proof, because you talked about it.
Smoothness is kind of an issue. Yeah, for sure.
But you don't know what the hell they use?
Yeah. We use at the house. Man, I'm just blanking out right now. My son's like just obsessed with the machine. No, it's the one that's like $1,000.
The Vitamix?
Yeah, Vitamix.
Oh, the blender.
Yeah, the Vitamix. No, there's blenders and there's Vitamix.
No, the Vitamix blender. Yeah. So use that?
Yeah, we use the Vitamix. And brings it in. And it's also like in the lemon juice. People forget, like, you got to use lemon juice.
A lot of lemon juice.
Yeah, a lot of lemon juice.
Garlic and tahini, right?
Well, I prefer no garlic myself.
So you just go lemon juice, tahini, and that's
simple.
It?
Yeah, it's simple. It was lemon juice, tahini, salt.
Yeah, right, of course. Right. Yeah, but no cumin, then, no garlic.
You can do cumin, a little bit of cumin if you want, just for the gas, to counteract the gas if you want.
Yeah, no
but
garlic.
I avoid cumin at all. In the falafel, I do cumin.
Yeah, but no garlic in the hummus.
I prefer no garlic.
But is that a purist thing?
It's a preference thing.
Oh, but
it's
so you can be do. In
Palestinians. Palestinians, I know as a whole, like really don't mess with garlic in the hummus itself.
Right.
Yeah.
But garlic in general is okay.
Yeah, garlic in general is fantastic. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh, you can eat it whole. Like, we eat it all. We don't mess around.
Yeah.
But if you have a fever, like, you put onions in your socks or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Apparently that works. I've never done it.
People will do anything if you tell them it'll work.
Like, I ate raw onions the other day. I was like, oh, man, I'm getting old. Like, who does that?
What, eat raw onions?
Just like...
Like just, what, a sweet onion or just like yellow onion, blue onion?
Just a white.
Oh, really?
I ordered Persian food at the house and I just saw them. I never eat them.
I just had the Persian food. What'd you have?
I'm going to do that. You know, the kubide, the classics, the kubide.
I always get, like, well, I'm vegan, so like, I get the fool.
Yeah.
I love fool.
Fool is like Egyptian thing for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it all seems to cross over a little bit.
You know, I think these guys, they come up here and they're just like, hey, I'm just going to mismatch my menu.
I don't know.
I don't like it.
It's literally,
Persian make Persian food. This is what you do.
It's a little literally the B story of both seasons of of your shows. Your problem with food mixing.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with it.
But you're telling me that Persian, that there's not crossover? I know there is.
Like, they put an insane amount of garlic in their hummus.
Yeah.
Like, their hummus is like garlic with a side of chickpeas. It's like unbelievable. You eat it, you're like, wow.
But the Persian baba is fucking great.
Delicious. No, Persian baba ganoush is probably the best baba ganoush.
It's that smoked eggplant.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, if it's done well.
No.
But
even
now,
the
like,
worst Persian I, spot does it decent.
Now I got to ask the guy if fool is Persian.
No. Fool is definitely an Egyptian thing.
Right, sure. But now I got to question his integrity.
Yes, I do. Yes, you question.
I have to say to him, so like, what is the story on fool?
Yeah,
I
mean, is your mother Egyptian? Yeah, Who's Egyptian in the family?
Why are we having this?
Yeah, why? What's your expertise? Who gives you the license to start making fool? That's what I want to know.
The first time I had fool was at a place in Boston that was, I guess it was Egyptian. It was a hookah place, which is another theme of everything
it
you do.
It does cross over to like Palestine and Lebanon because they do like touch borders. So it's like, ish, you know, so I mean, like very, very close. So they do like leak over, like we do, for instance, like fool with tahini in the middle. Like,
pasta?
And then drown, yeah, no, tahini.
Oh, tahini, yeah.
So I have to pronounce things.
Yeah.
So I like get on myself. Tahin. If I say like falafel, yeah. I'll die inside. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
It's yeah, falafel. A little bit.
Yeah, falafel. Yeah. A part falafel. Of me like disappears.
How do you say
my
hummus?
History like goes away. Hummus.
Hummus,
yeah, exactly.
And tahini
yeah.
is tahini?
Tahini, yeah.
Yeah.
Tahini, yeah. It depends.
I love it, man.
No, it's the best.
Yeah, and when you're vegan, it's like great. But how about that Persian cabbage salad? That's the fucking best.
You know, you lost me. You lost me at cabbage salad.
Really?
I'm good, yeah. I'm cabbage rolls. It's a whole nother thing.
That's cooked. The raw cabbage salad with the garlic and the mint.
Yeah, tomato. I'll just skyrocket into space. I mean, how much cabbage you've been farting all day?
It's, yeah, but
so much gas in that. I mean, like I figure, like
you get used to it, dude. You get used to it. Yeah,
but the
combo of the foo and the cabbage, you're good. You're good.
Oh my god,
you'll surprise yourself.
You'll kill everybody in sight. I'll get deported tomorrow. It'll be over.
So, this is a good conversation, you know, for me to have with you around, like, I imagine the first season. So the first season came out, what,
2022.
Now,
My luck has been extraordinary. We were pandemic, push. They had all kinds of issues with that.
Yeah.
And we had the writing strike also this season. So we were behind five.
So months. You're saying it's bad luck?
No. Oh. I'm just like.
It just happened.
It just happened.
But how, like, in the wake of October 7th, what?
My nephew's birthday.
Oh.
No, I'm just kidding. Oh. It's not a good joke.
what show was I just watching? Was that your show?
Wasn't my show. Yeah,
about the September 11th
thing?
Yeah,
he's like, oh, it's when's your birthday, 9/11? I go, actually, it is.
I saw somebody induced labor on the 10th so they wouldn't have a September 11th baby. I can't remember what it was.
I respect that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah,
good for you. You know?
But when that happened, you know, what were your feelings then on that day in terms of, you know, Palestinian Americans and what was happening? How did you feel on that day?
Devastated, shocked.
Yeah.
Just to give a little background, you know, we started the writing room. This is the only Palestinian show in America, like it's the first
in history.
It's kind of in history.
Sure, yeah.
I run the show.
Yeah.
It's my baby, and I have, you know, we started April 1st, and we went on strike May 1st, and we came back October 1st.
Yeah.
And then 6 days later, October 7th happened, and of course, like, you know, it's kind of pandemonium, right? Everyone starts reacting, everyone online, and then our writing room is just chaos.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is in a state of shock. And
How do we handle it?
Right. How do we handle it? What's the next step? What's the next move? And me being like a stand-up in front of the camera in Palestinian, so everybody kind of, what are you going to say? What are you going to do? Like,
right.
The pressure started happening and mounting. And, you know, I'm a person in like, real distress, I stay calm and I watch and I listen because I feel like everyone was just being wildly reactive versus just like, hey, what's actually going on here? What's happening?
Yeah.
Because I was mortified. I was like, oh, this is going to be it because the bombings in Gaza has been happening for quite some time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I remember filming Black Adam and they were bombing Gaza.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and I have to walk on set and there's like rubble everywhere. You know, it's just like it was kind of messing with my mind a lot, actually, and my emotions and my psyche. And so just seeing that, I was just mortified, honestly. I was mortified for what happened. I was mortified for the hostages. I was mortified for what's going to happen to Gaza.
And also how people will see Palestinians in that moment.
Also, like, what's the story? Like, it's just kind of, you know, I just as a logical, but forget that I'm Palestinian. Like, I try to think things through and see what happened. How could this even happen?
Yeah.
This is supposed to be like this, you know, you have Israel has the most advanced technology in the world. You have an Iron Dome. I don't even know how that works, right? So
and then there's the stories about Netanyahu knowing about it.
Yeah, it just sounds very similar to like 9/11. Right, Bush knew about it, this happened.
Right, did they let it happen for political reasons?
Right, right.
But I think the interesting thing—
But all that is just fucking noise, because in the end, the people,
people
get fucked.
People are dead and people
on
are
on both sides, because you radicalize both sides, like no matter what. Like, this is a really, really terrible thing, either way you look at it. You know?
That's it. Like you said, like as a Palestinian, that happens and all of a sudden everyone's looking to you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as the attempted annihilation of the Palestinian people progresses from that point on behalf of Israel, which is, you know, clearly, you know, a heinous moral and human tragedy that they set out to, you know, clearly destroy the Palestinian people. Then me as a Jew, people are like, well, what do you think?
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, well, I'm a Jew. I live in Los Angeles.
Right. Right.
But, you know, you're kind of put in this position, you know, to, you know, make these statements. I'm like, I'm a comic.
Exactly.
You know, because once it becomes political, especially stateside, that people need to be validated in their points of view that you are with them.
Exactly.
But,
and for me, from my perspective, I'm like, I spent my entire career being myself.
Right.
I've never like, you know, I'm not like, I mean, this is kind of an example, kind of throw him under the bus, but everybody kind of knows it's like DJ Khaled, like nobody really knows. Right.
Yeah.
Nobody really knows. He doesn't talk about it. It's not part of his like ecosystem. Like, that's not what he's known for. You know,
backstory?
He's Palestinian.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's Palestinian. Yeah. I'm saying nobody really like, it's not part of the zeitgeist. Like, nobody really like knows that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this is been my foundation because most people don't know what the hell I am and what that means and where I come from. That's why I did the specials the way I did and what the show is about. And so I have to stop answering these questions and kind of fill this massive gap, right?
Right.
So when that started happening, it's like, man, I of course you have to say something, but how you say it and how you do it is like everything.
Well, as a public person, you know, it's expected of you.
Sure.
You know, you know, but then you get into a zone where, you know, if you are not careful about how you speak about it, either on either side, you become a representative of something.
Exactly.
And even though what you're going to say isn't necessarily going to solve any problems, is that, you know, people need the alliance.
Right.
So they validate their own point of view. Like, there's no denying the fucking horrible massacre and annihilation on behalf of on the part of Israel in relation to Palestinians.
Yeah.
But if you start the dialogue on whatever platform you have, you're expected to continue that dialogue every day.
Exactly. You are. And that's like a massive trap.
Yeah.
A massive trap. That's why I didn't even talk about it within the season itself also.
Well, that was, because I was wondering about that. Because, you know, you're in the shadow of this thing, but yet your choice, and I think on stage as well, to identify as a Palestinian American to the point where in the second special, you know, you talk about, you know, white Americans don't have to put anything before American.
Right.
But, or Arab American. But but there is this need to, like, as an American, you know, you are an American.
Exactly.
So the community that you have, both, you know, with peers and with your Palestinian family as Americans, is the story. Right. So, and the way I thought you handled it in the second season, you know, because the tensions have always been there. There's never been a time in your life or my life.
It's like you have
the
to killings contextualize everything.
Right.
You can't. It almost makes it sound like everything started on October 7th.
Yeah.
And it's just couldn't be further from the truth. And then also you have to factor in, like, you know, by the time the show comes out, it's a year from filming.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Almost 14 months from writing it.
Yeah.
So all the things that could change and unfold within that time frame.
So you kept it within the family.
You have to keep it within the family. I started writing about it. I tried. I attempted to go down that rabbit hole, and we started going through it, and it became really didactic, and it became not about the characters. You weren't really attached to each other's emotions.
Yeah.
And it just became about the thing. And it was just... It was a trap. It was a clear trap to me. I saw it so clearly. I was like, oh, you know what? We end on October 6th, actually.
Yeah.
The whole season ends on October 6th.
Okay.
So, you know, whether you caught that little
nugget.
In
the show?
Yeah, in the show.
Okay.
There's like a little hidden nugget at the end. I don't want to, you know, spoil it, but yeah.
But and because of that, you're able to address the historical and what has been an ongoing threat and tension of, you know, from, because your family in the show is in the West Bank, right?
Yes, they are. And they are actual in reality. And everything that we show in, like, all the cutaways, all the village in the West Bank is the actual footage of my family's village, and it's my grandparents' house. It's actually my grandparents' house. Like, I was very deliberate about all of that, just be as realistic, as grounded as possible. And Burin also, as a village, is very unique in itself, which had a lot of artists come out of there. My family's contribution to that village has been significant, and what is given to us has been huge as well. So, I'm so tied to it.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I could live there, honestly. I wish I was able to go. I wish my mother, who was born there, could even move freely and go there.
Even
now, of course. Obviously, I wish the situation was different. I mean, my aunts can't even go to the doctor. I mean, it's like a 10-minute ride. It's 6 hours.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know, you can't go anywhere. You're completely confined to your home. And then there's all the settler violence.
Yeah.
And so that you can't, like, any day could be your last. Like, it's terrifying.
It's fucking horrendous.
Yeah.
And I thought that the way you handled that in the show was good, because it kept it personal, that, you finally get to go over there.
Yeah, it's my genuine
experience.
For the
first time. Yeah. And then, like, you got to deal with it. It's not even the Israeli army. Mm-hmm. It's the fucking settlers.
Right.
Yeah, now I'm going to get in trouble for just saying fucking settlers, let alone if any,
I, Moammer, did not say fucking settlers. No, I'm just kidding.
And this is not my real last name. And no, but I mean, it kept the conflict and the reality of the conflict personal.
It had to be.
Yeah.
It had to be. Anything outside of that is not true for myself. And then that's the best story I could tell. Right.
Right.
How can I tell the most honest story?
Yeah.
Is by, my own personal direct experience.
Yeah.
And of course, there were some storylines, some news cycles or anything that I would, just hear would happen in the village. I would,
Yeah.
I would write down. I mean, there was one that didn't even make it into that. It was like a flashback I kind of wanted to do in the show, but it would never fit. It was like my mom told me the story, how the settlers came down to our village. They stole all the olives that they had picked for the press. They stole everything. And so what did the Palestinians do? They went up to the settlements. It was very dangerous. And they stole their donkeys. And then the two elders got together and they did a swap for donkeys and olives. I wanted to call the episode Donkeys and Olives.
Yeah.
I just thought it'd be really funny to do, but also like a little insight
on
how you and how
that
you
there was
like,
a,
exist there.
A negotiation. Know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But now you have aunts that still live in
house aunts, in the West cousins, Bank? Cousins, yeah, plenty. On both my father's side and my mother's side.
And are they okay?
I mean, yeah. As
well, they're alive?
Yeah, they're alive, yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, yes, thank God. Yeah, they're alive.
Yeah.
It's not a normal life, You're confined to your home.
Yeah.
And my grandparents' house was, like, ransacked recently, and it's just so, I don't even know how to describe it, man. It's like your heart being ripped out of your chest, It's like, this is my grandparents' house. I want my son. I just had a baby boy, like, 14, over a little bit over a year ago.
Yeah.
I want to go experience this with him. I want him to see where he comes from. And it's just, I'm mortified. This is all going to be gone soon, Like, they're just going to take it.
It's fucking...
It's just like, it's so disappointing because there's all these wonderful stories from my grandfather and the relationships they had with Jews, Palestinian Jews, that lived there pre-48 Israel. And it was just like, they used to watch each other's kids.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, they used to watch each other's kids. Because, like, and they had this kind of life where they just would hang out all the time.
Yeah, they
and actually, like,
coexisted.
As far as, like, coexisted in a beautiful way. And it was, they're both Abrahamic religions.
Yeah.
They both believe in one God, one existence. Like, it's like, they're really very similar.
Yeah.
And both worked off of the lunar calendar. Everything kind of cycled together. And it was just like, it was really a beautiful life from what I've heard.
Yeah.
Pre-48.
Like, yeah.
I mean, obviously there was some, a lot of refugees that were coming in from Europe, even within World War I.
Yeah.
And that was escalating, but it wasn't anywhere near as bad as 48.
Yeah. And like, just not to make any comparison in any way, but that the association that happened, immediately and implicitly on the left was that, Jews are Israelis. That there was no, and it's the other way around. Israelis are generally Jews,
right?
But Jews, diaspora Jews, it's a complicated thing to understand,
right,
given what you're taught, and that's where it sort of, kind of, it was kind of bizarre that it kind of moved into almost anti-Semitism, that, yeah, you know, any Jew is aligned with this, you it's know, wild. This annihilation of Palestinians.
Yeah. No, it doesn't make sense. Also, the whole thing doesn't make sense. Like, if everyone's trying to kill you, wouldn't you want to not be all in one place? Like, it feels like the Jews are being set up, too. Like, it feels that way.
It feels
like, hey, you know, everybody wants to kill us, so we're going to go all to one place, make it easy for everybody. Like, hold on a second. Okay, so then who am I going to work with? Evangelicals. What do they want? They want to put you all in one place.
Yeah, so Jesus can come back.
Come back and kill all of you. Like, what is going on? It just doesn't, on a logical level.
And I'm not equipped to really speak to the history of it. But ultimately, you know, I thought you depicted it, you know, in a very honest and visceral way, so that, you know, people, even like me or anybody else, can understand the way of life and the cultural history.
Thank you.
Because the cultural history, you know, even as a Jew, is fragmented. Very few people have a real sense of historical community.
Right.
And I think that what comes across in the series, both seasons, is not like the way that religion is. It's not like Rami's show. Like, Rami's got a, you know, he's got a crisis of faith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he talks about religion. But in your show, you know, it's just a given.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
There's no questioning.
It's unbreakable faith. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's different.
But it's a
fine line between, like, you know, the religion. This is the thing. I think in this day and age, like, people say, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual.
Right.
Right? Like,
yeah,
I'm not
whatever
spiritual.
That is.
It's like, yeah, whatever. And I heard a beautiful summation of it. It's like, there was a man that converted to Islam, and he's just like, he used to be a crackhead. He was in jail, all this, and he changed his life, transformed everything.
Yeah.
And he says, religious people don't want to go to hell.
Yeah.
Spiritual people have been to hell and don't want to go back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's like an AA thing almost. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. I'm not familiar, but I'm, you know, I believe the family is definitely, you know, mom is religious, prays all the time. I think, you know, Mo tries, he fucks up a lot, you know, in the show.
But it's not a question. Cares.
Yeah, no, it's not a question at all. Yeah, they do believe.
You just get a little lazy.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely lazy, right. Yes.
Because, like, secularism, in my mind, is that you identify as the religion, but, like, yeah, I don't go to the mosque.
I
don't
I got
to,
you.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't go to church. You know what I mean? You're culturally Jewish.
Sure.
But religiously, maybe not.
Right, right. We still pop in, for sure. We still go to the mosque once in a while. We don't show it in the show, but we pop in.
Yeah, we
check in with God regularly, for sure.
But even in greetings, it's kind of beautiful that there's just this, like, it's all inclusive.
Yeah.
In, you know, just, you know, the beginning of any social interaction.
It's actually one of my favorite things. Yeah. And Common, who scored the show, with Kareem and Patrick, shout out, and he would always comment on, like, man, I love how you guys speak to each other.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it is like that. It's like the greeting, peace be upon you, and may peace be upon you and unto you and your entire family. Yeah. And it's like, wow. And then you say, hey, listen, did you pick up the fucking tiny?
Exactly.
Or not? You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's like that.
Yeah.
But also, like, in the time of the Prophet, upon him, they used to say before him, Kifak means how you doing.
Yeah.
And then after him, he would say Kif al Hal, which is how is your state?
Yeah.
How is your state?
Oh, that's
basically
interesting.
Like, how is your heart?
Yeah.
So it's this, it's just one word, but it changes everything.
Wow.
It's not just like, hey.
Yeah, yeah.
How you doing?
Yeah.
It's like, no, how is your
how
state?
Are you how really is your, doing?
How are you really doing?
Yeah.
So all these, like, little nuggets to me that are just really special in communication, in connection, in understanding, like, your spiritual self, the heart, the cleansing of the heart, the mind. Like, I'm not equipped to talk about it at all. What little I know blows my mind.
Like, well, but the habit.
It's beautiful.
The
ritual. The habit is beautiful.
Yeah, because it keeps you connected and it does have meaning.
And it's very sad, though, because even, you know, Arab Christians will also greet each other this way, but it's become such a stigma because of how Muslims are depicted, and so they won't even say Salaam Alaikum anymore, which it doesn't make sense. Not everyone, but there is some that feel like some kind of tension about it because, and I understand, like, the history of it all is so baked with so much tension, so they kind of want to separate themselves, but it's really not good. Actually, you should power through it and maintain this beautiful tradition where you greet each other with such, you know, love.
Yeah.
You know? And I talk about it in my special, Muhammad in Texas, when it's just like, hey, how are you?
Versus
assalamu alaikum. Versus really, really greeting each other.
Having that connection.
Yeah, having that connection, but with the intention of it.
Hey,
I'm aware. I'm like really tuned in.
And this is like all the, you know, the friends you grew up with and from the community. It's all this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And my uncle's, like, it comes from my elders for sure. My uncle who passed away like a year and a half ago. He's easily one of the greatest men I've ever known.
Yeah.
Just a beautiful man.
Yeah.
Just, but so consistent, never wavered, like always. He's just an example of a human, like for me, as a real, like, man. You know, like, took care of his 7 kids. He's so, like, successful.
He was in Texas?
No. He was in Amman, Jordan. And he worked for the United Nations, actually, and he spent his whole life, like, making sure that kids who were affected by war received restitution and were taken care of.
Yeah.
And he essentially spent his whole life just, you know, he was a doctor as well. He had a doctorate and a law degree. The guy's just an overachiever, basically.
But you knew him. You had a relationship with
him. Oh, yeah. He's the way, because I lost my dad when I was 14, and he was the one that always, like, he was like my guiding light with my mother. He was always that for me.
It's amazing because, you know, I read a book recently about, like, the fact that there is no, you know, cultural adhesive anymore for people from anywhere, because even people from places don't necessarily have a community.
Yeah.
You know, they may have a history, or they may have, you know, like, you know, something that they came from.
Right.
But I think what's great about your show and what you're talking about is that the connection to the people that you come from is active.
Mm-hmm.
And also you have a community here.
Absolutely.
So it has, you know, it runs deep.
Absolutely.
And for, you know, for centuries.
No, absolutely. And when I came to Houston, it was Hakeem Olajuwon for me. It was like I was like, oh, that's the guy. It was like, I didn't see any other Arabs really.
Yeah.
I didn't see like many Muslims.
How old were you?
I was 9 when I first came to the States. And Hakeem was like the guy.
Yeah.
He was like, oh my God, he's fasting.
Yeah.
During playoffs, and like, like I would have failed for sure. Like, he's so much better than I am. But it just, like, he was the guy in Houston that I looked up to. Like, oh, there is a sense of community. And then you see how diverse Houston kept getting, and then you start meeting all these people, and you create your own community in your own pockets, and you become like the guy. Like, oh, he's from, you know, he's the first Palestinian, or he's the first Iraqi guy. And the more war that would happen in the Middle East, the more Iraqis would pop up, which is really funny.
Yeah.
It's not funny. It's just how it works.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, too, that, like, Hakeem represented a way to maintain your cultural identity.
It did. And he was so attainable. Like, I would see him at the mosque.
Yeah.
He would just pop in.
Yeah.
And he would spend time with everybody. He was so nice. And actually, before my dad passed, he became friends with his brother.
Yeah.
And took me to a Nigerian mosque. And it was just won the championship. He's like, at that point, the best son in the game.
Yeah.
And just signing, hanging out, saying hi.
Being human.
High-fiving kids. Yeah, just being a great guy. And zero, like, I gotta go, last autograph, nothing.
Yeah.
Are you guys good?
Yeah.
Done, boom, leave. He, like, felt like this Muhammad Ali type presence.
Wow.
To him, where it was just so special.
So you got there when you were 9 with all your siblings?
No. It was my sister and I.
Yeah.
So my mom got us on a bus, went through Iraq.
During the Kuwaiti War?
I really hate saying Iraq. We went through there. During the Gulf War.
Yeah.
Part one. And then took us to Jordan, and then got us on a flight and ended up to Houston. And then, I just had a brother there that was studying, and that's how we set up shop there. And then my mom followed, my other brother followed, and my dad came about 2 years later, and then he passed away like 3 years later.
What happened?
He had a heart attack. He had a heart attack, was in the hospital. I really believe, like, first of all, rags to riches, and then riches to rags, like, just, and he was in his 50s, like, I got to start over. Like, I think that all just took it out of him.
It just
really, really took him out. You know, I really believe, like, it was just the stress of everything.
Well, the fact that whatever education or position they held, like, I had a landlord in Queens.
Yeah.
Well, I think he was Colombian, and he was a dentist in Colombia.
Yeah.
And he was now the landlord because he owned this building. And if your oven would fuck up, he'd come in and be like, you know, if it was a mouth, I could fix it.
My father was a telecommunications engineer. Yeah. He worked for the Kuwaiti Oil Company. He went to school in England. I mean, he was the first guy to really, like, introduce electronics to the village in Burin. Like,
oh, yeah, that's in the second season. Yeah, it is.
But he owned the electronic shop there, and he would teach people how to, you know, this is what it works. And I was surrounded by this tech, this early tech, and what he would do with it. And it's part of my life.
Well, it's so sweet that the second scene is in is such a honors him all the way through.
Yeah.
That was sort of like the destination of the thing. It's to honor your people and then to honor your father.
Absolutely.
Because that scene in the mosque where you got to do the call to prayer, it's kind of funny but kind of sweet. Tearjerker.
It's a real thing. You know,
I know. I saw it from the special.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And I wanted to add another layer to it. It's what really happened is when I found out, I kind of snuck away and just lost it.
Yeah.
It was joy and sadness all at the same time. Filled with it. It just immediately hits me every time I think about it. But it was just, it's just really special to be able to tip the hat. And the whole video camera thing is also real. That was a whole miracle.
Was the encounter with the Israeli customs guy real?
Yeah, I had, but not with the VHS tape, but there was several other things that I had from my grandparents' house.
It was kind of interesting that you went out of your way to, I don't know if it was driven by empathy, but you humanized even the worst of the people in the show.
Did I really?
A little bit. I mean, not specifically that guy with the VHS tape, but certainly the person, the woman asking the questions.
Sure, yes.
And you did it by making them comedic characters on some level.
I had to.
And so that makes them a real person as opposed to this fucking monster.
Right.
No.
I think it's important to break through.
Right? Yeah.
We spend so much time seeing the other version regularly.
Yeah.
And I think seeing that part where it breaks through, even the dream in episode 8, where he's just these Palestinian families are moving back and just joyful and leaving and seeing the guns being melted by the IDF. And then the reveal of Bob Ross. But Bob Ross is just me just speaking to them. Everyone.
Yeah, that was funny. Know? Yeah.
Just speaking to everyone. It's it's amazing what you could do when you change your mind.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It's amazing what you can do to change your mind. No more guns. No more war.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice. I'm in my happy place. You know? It's just telling them, man.
Yeah.
Think.
Yeah.
Think what it could be without all this nonsense.
I don't know that people, because people are so brain fucked. Yeah. And
I don't know how, historically, Jews who were fleeing persecution in Europe went to Morocco, Tunisia, these Muslim countries and sought refuge and they were fine.
Yeah.
Why are they the enemy? This is why I'm man, I don't trust anything. I don't trust it. I feel like it's a setup. The whole thing is a setup.
Yeah. So you just put that as your foundation and then move through your life.
Yeah. I mean, what am I supposed to do? I just don't believe what anybody says.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe. This is a world of fake news. I don't know what's real, what's wrong, who's personal interests, who's doing what. I have to maintain who I am, stay grounded in the stories that I tell. It's from my own lens, from my own experience.
Yeah, exactly.
And keep it moving. And stand-up is just that's why I fell in love with stand-up when I saw it when I was 10 years old. I was
Who'd you see?
My God. When I was 10, I went to my brother took me to the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo.
Yeah.
And it was co-headlined by the band Alabama and Cosby.
Wow. This is a pre-Monster Cosby.
Pre-Monster Cosby. He was America's dad at that time.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who that was. I've been in the country 6 months. I have no clue what Alabama is, livestock. I arrived 2 days before Halloween. 2 days later, I thought Americans were out of their fucking minds. Yeah. It was I've never seen cleavage. I didn't even know what the hell is it. It just freaked me out. Everything freaked me out. I was this place is a nightmare.
Yeah.
It was just, I couldn't believe it. I was what is going on? Why are they dressed like this? It's freaking me out. I was just didn't know what to do with it. So I didn't know anything.
Right.
And even when I first started stand-up in the late 90s, there was all these comedians, you sound like this guy, you sound like that. I'm who's Sam Kennison? I don't know who you're talking about. I've been in the country 8 years.
Yeah. I don't think you sound like Sam.
No, I mean, back then,
sure,
I was 17. I was screaming, I'm 17, bro. So excited.
You're full of it,
I'm full of it.
But so Cosby made an impression.
Yeah, Cosby.
It's interesting how many comics that... And I didn't see it till later, but Bill Cosby himself,
yeah,
that special.
Well, they showed it in our school also. They would show it in like free time.
Yeah.
It was clean. They would bring it in and watch it.
Yeah, it was. It's sort of an astounding, because that approach to stand up, you know, which that, you know, regrettably he is who he is, but that special, you know, changed my approach.
Yeah.
That jokes are important, but that stories are all jokes.
No, absolutely.
You construct the story.
And I come from a storytelling tradition. My mom would tell me all these amazing stories, and it's within my family. So when I saw it live in front of like 70,000 people on this rotating stage on a pile of sand,
right,
and he had everyone just at the edge of their seats, including me. I don't even know the fuck he's talking about. I'm 9, you know, but I just realized this was so funny. And his act outs was just like the way he told the story and how deliberate he was and how patient he was.
Yeah.
It just blew my little 9-year-old mind. Like, I just couldn't believe it. I looked at my brother. I was like, this is what I'm going to do for a living.
And you were 10?
I wasn't even 10 yet. I was 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he goes, you're out of your mind. And he's just like, okay, I was like, no, you don't understand. Like,
and it stuck with
you. This is what I'm supposed to do, idiot. Like,
that was your moment.
I'm like, okay, nobody gets it.
Religious moment.
Yeah, it was. It was. It was like, absolutely that.
Saw your whole life ahead of you.
Yeah, no, 4 years later, I started doing stand-up.
When you were 15?
I was actually 9th grade in high school. I was 14 years old. My father just passed. I was skipping school. I was like, didn't care about anything.
That sent you on a tailspin?
Send me out. I mean, I didn't give a shit. I was gone all the time. I would go to ball games, sit on a third baseline. Like, I didn't give a shit. I was just gone with my buddy.
Because you were sad.
I was very, very sad. I was very, very sad, distraught. Like, my life was so... Everything's upside down, completely. You know, everything's up. We're living in a one bedroom apartment. Like, what's happening?
Right.
So my teacher, my English teacher, is the one who actually changed my life. She goes, "Don't you want to be a comedian?" I was like, "Yes." She goes, "Also, don't you want to graduate high school?" I was like, "Of course." Be embarrassing. She goes, "How would your father feel if you don't graduate?"
Oh wow!
I was like, "You're the dad card." I was like, "You're evil. Like, this is fucked up." Right to the kisser, man. I started crying. I was like, "Oh my god, it'd be terrible."
Yeah.
And she said, "Listen, if you do stand up in class, you incorporate anything with that we're studying, which was Shakespeare at the time, then I'll give you extra credit and help you get by this year. But you're probably gonna fail."
Yeah.
You know. I was like, "That's fine." I was like, "I'll do it." I was like, "Can I do it now?" She was like, "Yes." I went up and did some stuff for Macbeth and from right out of the book, right out of text. And I was doing with the British accent, "To me or not to me." And, and the kids ate it up. And kids, I was their age, you know, like, and everybody's dying laughing. And I was like, "Can I do it tomorrow?" And she was like, "Yeah." She let me do it every Friday.
Yeah.
And then she took me to the theater arts department. No. I would just write my own material and do whatever. And
so you're doing like 14-year-old kid stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And then she took me to the theater arts department. She's like, "Listen, Lugene," she's my theater teacher. She was like, "This kid's been doing like all these accents, original material I've never heard before. I think he belongs here." And then the following year, I was like, doing leads and plays and musical
theater. And then you were able to lift up your other grades?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because you felt
passed
better
with
about
honors. Graduated early, graduated 17.
So it gave you a sense of self-worth.
Changed my life. Bro, I would skip, I got so good at it, I would put like the little Chris Farley jacket on, you know, fat guy in a little coat, and I would roast the class.
Yeah.
Right? I would roast all the class as Chris Farley, as a fat guy in a little coat.
Yeah.
I got so good at it, my Spanish teacher, Señorita Ferreira, she was like, "Can you do it for my other classes?" So she literally wrote me a note to skip the other classes.
So
I had 3 shows in one day. I'd be out in the hall wearing the little jacket. Everyone was like, "Mo, what are you doing?" "I got 2 shows. I got 2 more gigs coming up, you know? Just hang out."
Yeah.
And I would just do these things. It was like, I couldn't believe it was
getting
happening.
As many sets in as I can.
I got to do it, man. I'm about to graduate.
Got
to
go up the hall.
Yeah, exactly. 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 And that's it.
That's interesting that it saved your life, because who the fuck knows, you know, if you weren't able to process that grief.
Yeah.
You know, who the hell knows?
Yeah, I felt so alone. Like, everybody was dealing with so much. My mother was dealing with so much. It's like, I was by myself. I felt very alone in it, very alone in the process. But I wouldn't change a thing, honestly.
So when do you start doing clubs?
I did immediately. So this is hilarious. So Arab moms will volunteer you to other Arab business owners for work.
Yeah.
So I didn't even have a social at that point. So when I woke up one morning, my mom was like, "You have a job." I was like, "I'm gonna be a comedian, mom." She's like, "No." So she forced me to work at this flag shop. We sold fucking flags and import export shit. So I'm reading the Houston Press.
Yeah.
And I see Houston's Funniest Person competition at the Laugh Stop.
When it was still around, yeah.
When it was like one of the best.
Was Babbitt there?
He was, yeah, he was, he was. And so I go, it was like, oh shit, today's the deadline. I call my buddy Nick. I was like, you got to take me, I didn't have a car. He drives me over. I sign up. Before we went in there, Nick goes, you ready, Mo? This is the first day of the rest of your life. He was like being corny, but he was also very serious. I signed up. And then I went up on stage, you know, the next day I had to write some new shit. Like, I was like, I've been writing for like high schoolers, just like adults in there. Oh my God. You know, I got to like figure this out. So I wrote a bit, figured out like you needed 5 or 6 minutes, came in the next day, did well, like made the wild card position. And then Babbitt walks up to me. He goes, listen, it was great. How old are you? I was like, I'm 17. He goes, no shit jokes. Okay. If you want to ever work this club again, no shit jokes. No, I'm like, I'm fucking 17, bro.
It's all shit jokes.
17. It wasn't even all shit jokes. It was just like one.
Yeah.
I was like, just like, wait, I'm 17.
Oh, because he saw you do a shit joke.
Yeah. I was like, the thing. He was like, don't ever. I was like, I'm 17.
Yeah.
I just got here.
Yeah, shit is funny.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I get it.
There's always that guy, though, dude.
I'm going to build that shit. He was a huge prick to me. He was a huge prick to me. But then Danny Martinez, who owned the Comedy Showcase, was like, everybody was like, go develop there.
Yeah.
And I just saw everybody like just getting hammered. And I'm like, man, I got a Arab mom to prove wrong. You know what I'm saying? Like, I got to get out there, bro. They got to get this going.
And you can't get hammered.
He can't get hammered. Yeah. And Danny Martinez, who took me under his wings, who owned the Comedy Showcase, who mentored Ralphie May.
Yeah.
When nobody would put him on stage. Ralphie was like 700, 800 pounds.
Yeah.
And nobody would put him on stage.
It was hard to get him up there.
It was hard to get him up there. Rest in peace, Ralph. Rest in peace. Yeah. So it was like one of those things. And he like mentored him, mentored T'Shawn Shannon, who was like, who wrote for SNL for many years. So,
well, that was also like Ron White probably was around.
I'm not sure. Ron White was around. Yeah.
He's old school.
He was more last stop. Yeah.
Oh, he was.
Yeah, he was more last stop.
But T'Shawn had a brother too that did stand up.
Yeah,
I think.
Charlie Shannon. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew T'Shawn. What the fuck happened to that guy? Is he around?
I think he retired. I don't know.
Well, he was around for a while.
He was a head writer at SNL for like 10 years.
And then he wrote some other stuff. He wrote books. And he was kind of around.
He's great.
I haven't heard his name or talked to him in a long time.
After his brothers died, it was really tough. Because they used to do like Shannon's Christmas and, and all that.
Right.
I can't even imagine what that felt like. And Charlie was hilarious. Probably just so funny. He's spontaneously hilarious.
Yeah,
just
maybe
so
he's back in Texas.
Maybe. I got to check on him. I got to see. I'm sure somebody has his number.
Yeah. Usually if we have these conversations, someone will chime in,
right? Yeah. No, he's great. He's great. And so he took me on his wing, and Danny like literally mapped my entire career.
Yeah.
He goes, listen, you're 17 years old. He's like, all right, did a set at his spot. He goes, listen, this is what's going to happen. By the time you're 20, you're going to be headlining clubs. By the time you're doing this, 25, you're going to be headlining all over the country. You're going to be traveling the world.
Yeah.
This and that. And he's like, by 20 years, you're going to have your own TV show. You're going to have your own specials. This is what it is. But if you don't listen to me, you know, I'm not going to waste my fucking time. He goes, do you want it or not?
Yeah.
I was like, yes. Immediately, yes.
What's this guy's name?
Danny Martinez.
I didn't know that guy.
Yeah, Danny's the one who knew, like, he ran with the Ron Shocks, and he said he told me this great story. I mean, he had to fire Bill Hicks one night.
Sure.
He hired him at the
showcase. That's a long
showcase,
list of people.
And he was, he was hammered, walked the whole club, and he apologized to Danny. He's like, listen, tomorrow I swear I'm going to give you the best shows of my life.
Yeah.
And he let him come back and get 2 standing O's.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Next night,
two standing ovations.
I couldn't believe it. But he was, like, with the Ron Shocks and Jack Mayberry. You know Jack Mayberry.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive. Yeah.
Jack
Mayberry. He used to do Ross Perot on like Tonight Show and all that.
Oh, yeah, I remember Jack Mayberry.
But these were all like my mentors. Like Danny was
They were all still alive.
Yeah.
But Danny was a comic or just a producer?
Danny was a stand-up comedian, He was stand-up. He did like radio disc jockey for a while, and then Jack Mayberry is the one who got him into stand-up. And then he started doing that at the time where Kennison and Hicks were around.
Sure, the Outlaws. But he stayed in Houston.
He stayed in Houston. He started his own club. He's I don't want to I don't think he really wanted it. He just wanted to. He loved stand-up.
He did stand-up. Yeah.
He toured. He did all the runs and stuff. But he just opened up his own club and became like this developmental place in Houston.
That's great.
And man, that's where
But it wasn't the workshop.
No, it wasn't the workshop. No. He did do stand-up at the workshop.
Yeah, was that around when you started, or was it gone?
No.
It was gone.
I was too young then.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that you were able to see. It's a real gift because, when I was a doorman at the Comedy Store at 23, in the 80s, I got to see all these dudes.
That's amazing.
And it's a life changer because you can see all the different styles. You can see that, it's really up to you. You can do whatever the fuck you want. Just figure it out. And, you know, if you had some guy teach you, well, what did you learn from him? How did he take you through the paces?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
What did you learn from him, though?
What, from Danny?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I learned everything. Like, just like from eye contact to, you know, mic technique to, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. To, like, you know, being thoughtful with your words to...
What's eye contact? Because I don't think I know that one.
Well, the eye contact thing, and the eye contact thing is like, you know, you bring the audience closer. Like, you just don't be afraid of eye contact. I think I a lot up, of comedians
but I,
don't.
I end up locking in on one poor fuck.
Yeah, no, like, I don't. I switch it up.
And I don't realize that I'm doing it. Yes. And these poor people are like, yeah, terrified.
I switch it up. I always switch it up. And then he said, you know, you'll spend most of your life trying to be yourself.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
It's like imagine this brick wall. Yeah. And then every time you go up on stage, a little piece of that brick falls, and eventually there's no more wall.
Oh, that's
nice.
And
it's just you.
Yeah.
And it kind of made sense to me because I do, like, when you look, when I watch myself at like 17 or whatever, I have all those DVDs and stuff. And I look, I'm like, who is this kid? Look at this kid. Well, that,
I just saw some old stuff of mine because some guy's making a doc about me. And I gave him all these old tapes I hadn't watched in forever.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I see these bits and pieces of me in my 20s. And I'm like, I had all this swagger.
Yeah.
But there was no...
There's no joke. No.
There was no there.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, who was I pretending to be?
That's right.
So you got to come into it. But, like, when I watch it, I'm like, oh, my God. Who do I think I am, you know?
Well, you reminded me of Jimmy Pineapple. Do you know Jimmy Pineapple when he said swagger? Do you know that guy?
No, I don't know Jimmy Pineapple.
He used to run with Hicks.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Well, I knew Freddie Asparagus.
Yeah.
But Jimmy Pineapple used to be one of those guys.
And what's the other guy? I knew I was it. I was always it.
Yeah.
Even on the playground, his kid walked up to me and goes, you're it. And I go, you're goddamn right I am.
Who's that other guy that used to run with them? That, what was it, Stevie Epstein? Epstein?
Yeah.
Like, he was another guy.
I didn't know him, yeah.
Riley Barber.
I knew Riley.
Yeah.
I used to see Riley.
Yeah. Oh, wild.
So God, geez, all these names.
You got to see him.
I was so young, man. I was so young, and I just watched these guys, and they were just, it was a whole different world to just, like, observe.
And when does it take off? When do you just go the route?
I started touring immediately. I just started touring. The whole
as
thing
a
is
middle?
Like, yeah, I middled for like a year and a half, and that was it. And then it was like headlining right after that. I was just like so on the grind.
I was just at
it, man. I just wanted it so bad.
I didn't spend too much time as a middle.
No, I didn't give a shit. I hosted for like a month.
And it was like,
and then you middle, and you're like, nobody wants to follow you, and then you're gone, and then you start headlining.
You just have to figure it out. You got to figure it out. 40 minutes, and you're like, I can make up the other 10.
I had to like survive. Yeah. That's why when somebody says like, oh, I got a job, and I just stand up, I'm like, oh, you're not fucking real.
No, of course
not. Real. You can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're not like, where am I going to live? How am I going to survive?
Absolutely.
You're not going to be successful.
No, it can't be.
Never
you can't
be
have a plan B or a second job.
What are you talking about?
It doesn't even exist.
You're
in
still
your
an
head.
Engineer. You're a failure.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You're never going
to
make it.
I was just fortunate that I started after I was here as a doorman and I got fucked up on drugs, went back to Boston.
Yeah.
And that was
that's a great spot.
But it was a one-nighter economy.
Yeah.
So, and there were two-man shows. So the way I avoided road middling was I'd go out on these two-man shows when I was just starting out. I was just thinking about it because I watched this shit the other night.
Yeah.
I was like maybe 2 or 3 years in.
Amazing.
And I what the fuck? You know, when I see 2, 3-year comics now, I'm like, holy shit, you can't do anything.
No, you can't do anything.
But
they're all in one place. They don't travel. They don't go see anything.
But I'm going out to these fucking hell gigs, one-nighters, and I got to do a half hour.
Have to.
And so, like, after, you know, a couple of years of that, I was ready to headline.
Yeah.
You know, but and I thank God that I avoided that whole opener middle kind of thing. I middled a bit, but not much.
So Danny really fucked with me. He kept having me open, you know, whenever he started actually paid and all
at
that.
At the club.
I was like, why are you doing this to me, man? I'm so much better than some of these guys. Like, what are you doing to me?
Yeah.
He goes, Mo, I want you to be an amazing MC.
Yeah.
Until I see you're an amazing fucking MC, I'm not going to do it. Because if you're an amazing MC, one day you might host the Oscars. One day you might host the Globes. Maybe you'll ask me to host some giant event. Like, this is the great MCs always come back. Look at Billy Crystal. This and that. I was like, oh, interesting.
But also,
I looked at hosting in a completely different light.
Right, it's a job of a comic. A comic is a comic.
He goes, look at you. You always say, let's keep the train rolling. You guys ready? The show has already fucking started.
Yeah.
What do you mean you're ready?
Yeah.
Are you ready to get the show started? You just did a set, asshole. I mean, the show already started, so you're not part of the show? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Until you stop doing these little stupid things that you keep repeating.
Yeah.
Oh, let's keep the train going. Everybody's keep the train going.
Yeah.
You're saying the same shit. It's not interesting. That's why you're not moving up.
Wow.
But you're ready. You could, yeah, you could feature, you could headline them tomorrow. Yeah, I'm sure you
But
can.
Not here?
But not until you start doing this stupid, like, rookie shit.
I guess it makes you...
It changed my whole mind.
It gives you a sense of graciousness, too.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's your job to hold the show together.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But also he taught me, he was like, you can't host. You know, you're like, you only got like, you know, 30 minutes or something. You need like an hour to host.
To host?
That's what he would tell me. I was like, okay. I was like, I need an hour to host. I was like, why?
Yeah.
Why? He goes, well, there was a time where I was on stage and the guy wasn't ready or the guy wasn't there.
Yeah.
And I end up opening with 47 minutes.
Yeah. You got to be ready.
That shit's going to happen. So I tore Chappelle for years, right? Dave is filming Equanimity.
With Chappelle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's filming Equanimity. He hits me up to go do the shows with him.
Yeah.
I don't even know. It's just he and him, usually Donnell and I hanging out. It's just Dave and I doing it.
Yeah.
The tapings.
Yeah.
And then I'm on stage and I see Cena. He's like, five more minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, yeah, no problem. Yeah. Fucking no problem. Five more minutes. Boom.
Oh, they're waiting for Chappelle and you're stuck up there.
Something's happening.
Yeah.
Stuck up there. Are you kidding? It's the fucking Warner Theater. Give it to me, baby. You know, I'm in. Let's go. Yeah. 15 minutes turns into 20. Okay, no problem. He runs out. He goes, 10 more minutes. I was like, okay. Yeah. Fucking great. I hope Dave is okay. I'm doing the jokes. I'm thinking. Yeah. I was like, I hope he's fine. Like, shit. Yeah. Okay. I do another. Just like, we got two shows. He's got a tape. Like,
yeah.
It's fucking not a joke. So I do it. I'm like 30 minutes in, right? And I start doing this. Like, look at the clock. I'm like, okay. I'm like 12 minutes now. I'm sure it's good now. He hasn't come back out.
Yeah.
So I'm about to say goodnight. He runs out and goes, 10 more minutes. I was like, well, I'm editing all the jokes.
Yeah.
So, because I don't want to go over. I was like, shit. So I do another, another like, I do 15 more minutes. Okay.
So you get 45, 50.
I'm like 45 something minutes. And I say, okay, thank you, good night. He runs out and says, stretch.
Oh my God.
So I already said, thank you, good night.
Yeah.
So I can't go back into materials. So I freestyle.
Yeah.
Start fucking smashing, freestyling. And it was like, that's what it was about. That's all that training.
That's what he was. Danny was trying to tell you.
It just hit me. It was the first time I ever experienced that, and it was at the biggest stage.
Yeah,
it was his home, DC, big homecoming.
Yeah.
First time he does a special after all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
This and that, you know, like it just was.
What the fuck was the problem?
It was a patch, sewing a patch on his on his fucking.
On his jacket.
A
Chappelle patch.
And I was doing this joke. It was so funny. He was cracking me up. Because I was doing this joke. I sat next to Eric Trump. It became a whole thing or whatever. And it's before I taped it. And I said, and I see Eric and he's wearing his, you know, his own last name. It's like, that's for like the stupid kid that don't remember where he's from.
He has
to look at it. And he was getting his name. Dave was getting his name stitched on his jacket as I was doing that joke. And he was like, aw.
Did you bust on Eric?
I busted. During the show? Yeah, I fuck with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I sat, it was right after his dad was elected the first time, and I sat with him, and I didn't intentionally sit with him. Obviously, I got upgraded and all that, and did that whole thing.
But. Yeah. So by the time you work with Chappelle, you're a national headliner anyway.
Yeah.
You've been going for a while.
Yeah.
But did that change the career trajectory?
Yeah. It was like, you know, whatever mentorship I had with Danny, it was another level that Danny didn't really know about.
Right.
You know, didn't experience it consistently.
Yeah. But he set you up.
So it was a different level. Yeah. It was a setup of more of like, it was just a different grind and a different experience.
Well, Danny was like, this is how you work as a club comic.
Yeah, this is how you work as a club comic. This is how you be great. This is what you can do. Yeah. But then to experience it firsthand, to do it day in and day out, and then each venue is different than the other. I mean, you could be in a huge outdoor. You could be in a little theater. You could be, you know, at Shoreline Amphitheater, which I'm sure you've done when they were doing those shows. And it's like, you could be following Nas one night. You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do then?
Not exactly my world, but
But I'm saying it could be any situation.
You're ready to
go. Have to be ready for it. And then when you're just like, your gun's always loaded and ready to go.
Well, when did you feel like, you know, that you had your people?
I've had this like very unique trajectory. I started in the clubs, hammering away. And then there was this tour called Love Made Me Funny. And I was like, this sounds like Disney. Like, what the hell is this?
Yeah,
what is this? It's like so religious. I don't know about it. And then it was two like real comics that put this whole thing together like in 2004 or 2005.
Muslim comic tour?
Yeah, it was like a Muslim comedy tour.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, this is for Muslims only. Like, it was just like this community project. And then it blew up. And they asked me to be a part. I was like, yeah, let me try it. Let's see what this is.
Sure.
And then we started touring the world.
Like the world.
Like the world, man. Yeah. We were doing the Apollo in London. We sold like 8,000 tickets in South Africa.
Wow.
We did Australia. We did, you know, Scandinavia. Yeah. We were just touring all these markets. Before even Live Nation was there.
Now I'm going to pronounce it right. Mostly Muslim audience?
Muslim audiences. Yeah, it was like, it was a mix. We were like in Amsterdam, and it was like half Muslims, half Dutch people. And it was just mixed because of all the different, you know, politics that were going on in those regions. So people were interested. And, you know, all these different reviewers would come out in England. We did like 30 shows in 28 days. And the same thing. And we're in a van just touring Europe.
Yeah.
It was just, but we were just, I was just doing my own shit that I was doing in the stand-up scene. And it's something that Danny told me early on too, is like, be clean. You don't know when you're going to use it. It's easy to be dirty, but learn how to be clean.
Yeah.
It was like, no problem. So when I stepped into that world, I was still doing my regular material.
Yeah.
It wasn't. And then I would find new nuggets that I didn't
but
get
you had to
experiment
go clean?
With before. Yeah, it was completely clean. And I would come back to the States, do the club thing.
Yeah.
So it was like I had my peoples, but I didn't. You know what I mean?
But
like
that built you a huge audience.
It built me a huge audience. It built quite a history of it. And it also inspired a lot of these kids that would come to these shows. Sometimes there would be like, you know, young teenagers that would come to these shows because it was a clean that eventually started stand-up because of it.
Yeah.
And we were in markets before even Live Nation got there. I remember we connected like Bill Burr with the promoter in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
You know, like Bremen Theater. And he was like, we should, you know, you should get Bill. You should talk to Bill.
Sure.
Doug Stanhope.
Yeah.
They weren't like there. So it was just, people couldn't believe, like, you're really doing shows over there? Like, you still do stand-up? This is before YouTube, like, really popped off.
Oh, it was a while back.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Because, like, those are markets. I think I did Amsterdam.
Yeah. I'm talking about, like, 2005,
Norway,
6, Sweden. 7.
Yeah.
It was, like, a thing. It wasn't, like, really a big
because
thing.
Because I noticed in the special you taped in Houston that, and it's kind of beautiful that you do have a big Arab community.
Yeah.
That shows up.
Well, those people were Mexican. You know, you just...
Well, brown is brown. Like, what are you getting nitpicky for?
No, I was just saying, like, you know, and from show to show, honestly, it's I'm so blessed because it'll be like, it'll be a lot of Arabs one show. And then the next show, it's like, we're, you know, two Arabs.
Yeah.
It's like, what's going... Like, it's just...
Yeah, they
got... hilarious.
They,
and also, Arabs are kind of like lazy with buying tickets.
Yeah.
So then it'll bitch at me, like, hey, all tickets are gone. Like, buy tickets, bro.
Yeah.
Get on it.
And you really speak Spanish?
No, I do. I'm conversational in Spanish, completely conversational.
Did you just pick that up?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I learned it in 3 months.
Yeah.
I learned it in 3 months. And I'm just going to say, I fell in love with this girl. I was 19, of course. She was Brazilian.
Yeah.
Still friends to this day. Anyway, it doesn't matter what her name is. But she spoke Portuguese and Spanish.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Brazilian Portuguese is like impossible to learn.
Yeah.
So in 3 months, I was like, fully conversational
figured
in Spanish. And my mother and my family could not believe what was happening. My brothers thought I was full of shit.
Yeah.
And then I'd be translating on the spot.
Yeah.
And they were like, I don't know how this happens. I was like...
Because in the show, I'm like, wow, you really fucking knows it.
No, I do. It just takes me like a couple of sentences just to feel comfortable and then I can run with it.
But that must be helpful when you're performing in Houston.
It's great when I'm performing anywhere.
Yeah.
When I'm in Europe, I could just switch at any moment in time. Like, I could just... Just getting
Spanish?
Through life.
Yeah.
Just getting through life, period.
I wish I had a knack for it. You must have a knack for it.
I think it's just learning Arabic first really helped everything for
me.
My father was very diligent about education. And in the beginning of, like, I was 3 years old, I was learning multiple languages.
Yeah.
It was just...
So you had
I was going to school for,
had a brain for
English
it.
And Arabic.
Yeah.
I would go to Arabic class, English class, and it was just mandatory.
Well,
in the house.
The show is great.
Thank you, man.
Comedy's great. It's good talking to you.
Comedy's great. I can't believe it's over already.
How long are you in L.A. for?
This week. I'm just leaving Sunday.
You doing spots?
To do press. Yeah, I'm going to pop in tomorrow night probably.
Over at the store?
Yeah, I think so.
I got to go up to Santa Barbara.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Oh, you sound like you're so rich. I just have to go to Santa Barbara.
No. I got to do a show.
No, I'm just kidding.
I got a show Santa Barbara, and then I do San Luis Obispo, and then I do Monterey. Going to take Blair Saki.
That's dope.
Great. Go do the shows.
No, I love it. No, I just wanted to make sure that it was like clear about what the message of the show is. It's really like about family. It's really about this beautiful Palestinian family trying to be seen and trying to fit in a world where they are completely misunderstood.
And also you deal with like the whole notion of deportation. And that's another that device of getting you into Mexico without a passport, yes, and then, you know, and without having asylum status.
Thank you
was
for
very
recognize
funny.
That. Thank you.
Well, but it was one of the, another case where you, yep, you deal with that customs, that border official, and you make him a person.
No, I did. Yeah, and that was something that I really was important to me, because it was just like, first of all, showing how privileged the character was,
yeah,
in being a refugee. Like, Mo is a character, even though he's a refugee, he's very lucky.
Yeah.
And he has it. He's so well off in comparison.
Yeah.
So just in a half hour show, trying to execute all that is kind of difficult. So we having a guy like talking about his experience, like, you know, navigating through the jungles of Panama and, you know, dodging snakes and then the cartel and, you know, drinking the juice of a Vienna sausage can. Like, it's all we had to survive. And then he's asking Mo, like, how'd you get here? Like, I took a bus from Mexico.
Yeah.
But also, like, this detention center officer, too, is very interesting to me. Like, this guy's in a detention center of himself. Like, he's in jail himself. Every day he's there. Yeah. Like, I'm very curious about what he feels inside.
Yeah, it was good.
It was all that, just exploring all that. But yeah, thank you for having me, man.
Great, man.
I just love, always wanted to talk to stand up with you, and I knew that we would vibe on the Houston scene and all that, man.
It was great, dude.
It was dope, man. Okay, good to see you, man.
Good to see you. There you go. Great conversation, great guy, funny guy. His show, Mo, is streaming on Netflix. Hang out for a minute, folks. We've got new outtakes from recent episodes available for full Marin listeners. You can hear stuff that didn't make it into the shows I did with Ariana Grande, Demi Moore, James Mangold, and Bill Burr. I still like the guy. Just some people turn a certain way, and you hold on to what's good, and you let go of the other stuff.
I know.
You know,
there are so many people that, like, I just, you know, when I hear it, sometimes they'll say things and it's just like, have you ever just thought about, like, maybe taking a couple days off the internet?
Yeah. No, I mean, like, it's a very
because
hard...
no matter what you think, no matter how fucked up a thought you have, there is a website that agrees with you.
Sure, of course. That's the latest bonus episode for Full Marin subscribers. We do bonus episodes twice a week, and you get every episode of WTF ad-free. To subscribe to the Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Yes, here's some, this is some, this good vibey guitar here. Okay. We'll be right back. Rumor lives. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere.